From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
Welcome to School Talks. On this edition of the program, we're going to step outside of the classroom and visit with some of our friends in and around Detroit who make up some of the most creative field trip opportunities for students. Joining us on the program is Amy Green, the director of the Belle Isle Nature Center, Dr. Claire Lanoy Hall, the director of education for the Detroit Zoo. From the Detroit Institute of Arts, we have the Walters Family Director of Education, Jason Gillespie, and from the American Heart Association, Mallory Applewhite. All this and a whole lot more coming up right after this. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on School Talks is Amy Green, the director of the Belle Isle Nature Center. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Thank you.
So with the warm weather coming, I wanted to have you back on School Talks to give our listeners an update on the Nature Center, how it's gone this past school year, and some of the new features. And what coming up this spring could visitors expect to see at the Nature Center?
Thank you for asking. It's a great time to be at the Nature Center in the spring. It's a great time to be on Belle Isle in the spring. And we've got plenty of events lined up and plenty of programs lined up. There's something for everybody.
So a question, I read in some of your information, Blackbirders Week. Now, being a Beatles fan and their famous song Blackbird, I don't know if there's any correlation or what, but tell us a little bit about what that week entails.
Yeah, I'd love to. So Blackbirders Week, this is our fifth year participating in it, and it's really a celebration, just a vibrant celebration of diversity in the outdoors. There's certainly plenty of biodiversity in the world of birds, and we want to make sure that we're promoting inclusivity in nature spaces, recognizing contributions of blackbirders. And once again, this is for experienced birders, people just beginning, people who have never birded before. There will be a place for everybody to come, to learn, to connect, celebrate the joy of birding. You can borrow binoculars. We've got some great partners joining us, Black to the Land Coalition, the Sierra Club. So it's going to be a great event. That's May 31st from noon to 4 p.m.
And, you know, speaking of birds, it seems like in the last year, 18 months, I've seen more and more social media posts about eagles that are living somewhere near the lake, St. Clair Shores area, and people take a picture of it and post it and so on. And I also am aware something known as an eagle cam. It's out in California. And that's, you know, way up in the trees, and there's a camera there where you can watch the eagles give birth and so on. And my wife has taken an interest in watching the development of the eagles and at what point do they leave the nest and so on. Does the Nature Center have any kind of webcam type stuff that's accessible for people?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm going to back up a little bit, though, and say for all of your teachers out there, just running that eagle cam in the classroom is a really cool thing to have on in the background. I used to do that when I was a teacher, and it was always compelling. At the Nature Center, we don't have an eagle cam. Unfortunately for the eagles on the island, they're very resilient. Thrice their nest has blown down in the wind. They like to build their nests in old dead trees. It gives them a sense of security. They can see what's around them, and they're nice and high. And those are the types of trees that fall in the storms. We don't have the eagle camera. We set up trail cameras with student groups all of the time to see who's in the spaces when we're not. We have a really cool program with an app called iNaturalist, where people act as the cam, and they take pictures and share the pictures that they've taken with the community in this participatory science project, if it's double or triple verified, it goes on for research scientists mm-hmm. to know who's where. And we're having both the Detroit Zoo and the Nature Center are going to participate in this City Nature Challenge on April 25th through 28th. All three counties, Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb, are invited to use that app, take pictures of the eagles, plants, animals, insects, as long as it's not a pet or a person, and contribute to this huge blitz of social and participatory science.
You know, what a neat and positive use of social media. You know, it gets so much bad press nowadays with stuff in schools. It's nice to see it being used positively. So from high up in the eagle's nest down to what I would think is ground zero on in the water and such, tell us a little bit about the bullfrogs
and
what's happening there.
I would love to. At the Belle Isle Nature Center, this is celebratory for us. There are two new bullfrogs in our bullfrog habitat. There is one that's been there for a very long time, and it is massive. If you hold up your hand and look at it, the frog's about the size of your hand, that bullfrog. The two new ones, this is not entirely typical most of the time, but we did get a permit with the Department of Natural Resources to collect eggs. Before they even become tadpoles, if they become tadpoles, there's a potential for chytrid fungus, which is very harmful for amphibians. So our zookeepers raised these from eggs, spent most of the fall and winter caring for them, raising them. They're healthy, strong, and happy, and they're out on habitat. They're adorable. They share this little log together. Sometimes they sit literally on the head of the old bullfrog who's showing them the ways. And one thing that a lot of people don't know about the animals at the Belle Isle Nature Center, they're all named after Detroit musicians or Detroit area musicians. Oh. So our old bullfrog is Blob Seeger. And the two newest ones are Jay Dilla and Big Sean. So come and check them out. They're delightful. They're fun to find in there. And kudos to our zookeepers for caring for them.
Nice. We're currently with Amy Green, the director of the Belle Isle Nature Center. Amy, with schools in the next few months coming to a close, I understand the center has an opportunity for summer employment for youth. Hoping you could shed some light on that for students who might be interested in a summer job.
I would love to share this opportunity. We are currently hiring for 10 interns aged 16 to 19 years old. Requirements are residents in the city of Detroit, and it's an 8-week-long internship. This is our 10th year doing this with just tremendous support from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. So there are job skills and workshops and resume building, public speaking. They are learning all about different opportunities for natural resource careers in state parks. They learn about recreation opportunities in state parks. They learn from all of the experts at the zoo and local partners, and they leave the program with certifications like CPR and first aid. We're working on getting them OSHA certified this year, so they really become valuable in what they're learning and what they can contribute next. The pay is $15 an hour, and the application is up. It's called Environmental Stewardship Internship, or the Summer Youth Employment Program.
And you're above and beyond the wage, just the opportunity to work there, gain that kind of experience. Much like students who explore career paths, it
yes.
really helps students understand what a potential line of work in this field would look like, and in many cases, helps them make good decisions. So, Amy Green, the director of the Belle Isle Nature Center, thanks for stopping by. Keep up the great work, and we'll certainly have you back soon. Thanks.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, we're going to head over to the Detroit Zoo to learn about all the opportunities for children there and maybe even get an update on the new baby gorilla. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Dr. Claire Lenoy Hall, the Director of Education for the Detroit Zoo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So the last time we were together, we were talking all about the opportunities at the zoo available for students. And I wanted to drill down on something that we had spoken about before that I really think is important at the zoo. Many people who may not be as close to the zoo think it's just there seeing a bunch of animals, and it's so much more than that. And I wanted you to share with us a little bit of how the hands-on learning plays a role when children visit the zoo.
Great question. And I'm super excited to share a program that we actually just wrapped up. We just finished seeing all of Detroit Public School's sixth graders and then all of Rochester's sixth graders, and they both did the same program. And it is a comparison of predator-prey relationships on Isle Royal, which is a conservation initiative that we've been involved with for several years. But what we did to make it really hands-on, we used to use paper moose bones that were laminated, and we're like, we can do better than this. So we got a 3D printer, and we literally 3D printed hundreds and hundreds of moose bones and put them out in the zoo, just like you would find them up on Isle Royal, to try to determine what predated the moose, if it starved to death, if it was just old age, if a wolf got it. And the kids were able to do this whole hands-on investigation, apply what they had found, and use that to back up their evidence and their claims. And it just took it to the next level, right? Just like you were talking about. It's not enough just to go out and see the animals and look at them, which is still amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But to have the opportunity to actually put your hands on artifacts that help you really learn all these pieces and parts and get a feel for what real-life conservationists do in the field, including braving the weather on some kind of frigid March days and April days, but really a really unique opportunity to engage a little bit further than most individuals have the opportunity to.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to walk through this because I think this is really important, the way the zoo tailors experiences based on the age of the children. So, for example, the elementary experience is somewhat different than at the high school level. Could you share some perspective on how each of the age groups has a different experience at the zoo?
Absolutely. I have a team of amazing professional educators, many who've come from the classroom, so they know exactly what the different developmental needs of the students are. So whether you're a preschool and we are building your wonder and wow and amazement for the animal world, and we do that through sharing like the different sizes of animals, the different colors, different shapes and camouflage, or if you're in high school and you really want to dig down deep into some of these different career opportunities and really get a feel for what it looks like, and all of a sudden you're out doing pH testing and looking at the water quality, we're able to scale depending on what classroom is coming to us. And while the district partnerships have really helped us because we can tie in exactly to what's happening in a district in the classroom, we can still do something similar for the one-off teacher who calls up and wants to bring their kids out. But we are absolutely committed to making sure that we're meeting our students where they are, because we want them to have a really memorable, lasting experience. So we spend a lot of time and energy making sure that we do that.
And you know, one thing I appreciate is as students get older and they become more aware of their impact on the world, how a high school student might receive the zoo from a global perspective, whether it's conservation, protection of animals, the environment. And I really appreciate that. And you mentioned, you mentioned the word one-off, and I want to share an experience I had. Several years ago, I made the very wise decision to purchase a zoo membership.
Thank you.
And you know, when I was a kid, to go on a field trip was a day-long mission, especially for the adults. You know, you're packing snacks, the wagon. And one of my most important things I want people to understand is when you go to the zoo, you don't have to go there for 10 hours, you know, in the middle of July when it's 100 degrees. And my point to this is I regularly stop by the zoo, even if it's for a half an hour, to see the penguins with my grandkids or what have you. And if you approach it from that perspective, it really becomes almost like a mall for opportunities for children. And it really changes the perspective. I see this all the time in the summer where the family's pulling the wagon and they have, you know, 200 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And it's just like a journey. And if you change the mindset, it really is a fascinating place just to stop by. And that's one of the benefits of a membership as opposed to paying every time you go, especially if you commit to going regularly. So one last thing I wanted to ask you, we're currently with Dr. Claire Lannoy Hall, Director of Education at the Detroit Zoo. As the weather gets warm, and I understand there's a new baby gorilla that was born in, I think, last August?
Yeah, August 8th.
Tell us a little bit about how she is doing.
Well, Tama's doing fantastic. This is the first baby gorilla born at the Detroit Zoo, I think, in the history, which is amazing. We just finished construction on two new climbing structures out in the Great Apes Yard. So both the chimpanzees and the gorillas have access to these new spaces that are just going to be fantastic for their well-being. And they are just starting to get access outside on the warm days that are finally starting to get here. But definitely worth a stop by. And to your point about the membership, these are great opportunities to come out for short periods of time, see what the animals are up to. But we anticipate that they are very much going to enjoy these new climbing structures and spend a lot of time outdoors. And I think she'll be easier to see as she gets a little bit older. I know when she was first out, Mom was keeping her really close because Mom was doing a fantastic job. So we're looking forward to her being out and exploring the yard a little bit more this year.
You know, frequenting the zoo more often takes the pressure off having to take all these pictures.
Exactly.
Right? And I really appreciate the idea of going to the zoo and not having to have the pressure of capturing, you know, 200 pictures of a gorilla that are all relatively the same. And the frequency really takes that. Because, you know, once you have a few, you have a few.
Yeah.
But if you really approach it from a place of visitation, like a mall,
yeah,
it really changes the experience. And it really is just a great place for kids and families. As we approach the warm weather, coming to the zoo, what could people expect to be brand new there as far as exhibits or other things?
So I'm super excited to share that each year we do something new on our attractions trails. We've done dinosaurs in the past. We've done Brick Live. This year, we're doing dragons and mythical creatures, which is going to be phenomenal. That will start Memorial Day and run all the way through Labor Day, but it's a 3-acre trail that's all kind of secluded. It is an extra admission fee to go on that trail. But like I said, dragons, fairies, the education team has been working really hard to connect some of these mythical creatures with the inspirations from the real world creatures to help draw those connections for guests. And there's a special quest that you can go on. So totally worth the effort, adding a little bit of magic and whimsy to your summer, but definitely worth checking that out this summer.
And along with the baby gorilla.
It
truly is an experience. And you did mention before, the gorilla is now coming outside.
On the warm days. So they have access and they have a lot of choice. So if it's warm enough and Mom says yes, then she can go out
sure.
and play.
yeah, because that is an entirely different experience than viewing them through glass and
whatnot. Absolutely.
So Dr. Claire Lannoy Hall, thank you very much for joining us. I'll leave you with this. The chicken tenders by the merry-go-round.
Yes.
Some of the best ever.
Thank you.
They are high on the list.
I'll pass your compliments along.
Very much so. So I appreciate you joining us here on School Talks, and keep up the great work. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
After a word from our sponsors, we'll chat with Jason Gillespie from the Detroit Zoo. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is the Walters Family Director of Education Programs for the Detroit Institute of Arts, Jason Gillespie. Welcome to the program, Jason.
Well, thanks for having me back, Robert. It's a real pleasure.
I really appreciate you taking time to come back and join us on School Talks. And I think, you know, before we get into some of the changes and exciting stuff going on, I think it's important for us to remind our listeners about how Tri-County residents are able to attend the museum. Tell us a little bit about that and what that means for them.
For sure, and I can't remind people enough enough about this awesome benefit. So yeah, if you are a property owner in Wayne, Oakland, or Macomb County, you pay a small tax. And as a result of that tax that supports the museum, you get free admission to the museum if you live in those three counties. But what's probably most relevant for this audience is schools in those counties get free field trips. And not only are the field trips free, but we even pay for the bus transportation costs. We'll either write the school district a check for using their buses, or we'll send one of our buses out. We also provide free professional development for teachers. You can go on our website, dia.org, and there's a page for learning, and there's a whole calendar of our upcoming workshops. And not only are those workshops free, but we'll even pay for the sketch credits. And usually there's a nice little breakfast and lunch involved in our workshops now. So it's an amazing benefit for local schools, educators, students in the Tri-County area.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned sketch credits. Those are continuing education credits that teachers need to remain certified. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Those are the credits that you need to maintain your certificate every 5 years.
As a teacher. Very nice. You know, I had an opportunity to look at the reports that are on the website detailing the Tri-County interaction with the Institute, and it is impressive. Thousands of people are coming there from the Tri-County area, so it's nice to see the millage. I think it was 2012.
It was the first one was 2012, and then it was just renewed again actually a week before the pandemic shut the world down. The voters renewed the millage for another 10 years.
And you know, a millage renewal like this around arts and culture speaks volumes to the good work you're doing there for people to value it enough to support it again.
So I think so, too.
That's a really good thing. So, with a little less than 2 months of school remaining for most students in Metro Detroit, many schools are still taking advantage of field trips to different places, like you mentioned. And I'm curious, what are some of the changes coming to the museum that you'd like to share?
Yeah, there are some big changes, and that's kind of my job right now is to communicate these, because we all have favorite artworks, and I know teachers plan field trips to plan for their students to see particular works of art, but we have some exciting changes going on in our galleries. However, these changes do mean that some of our spaces are going to be off view while those changes are being made. The big one right now is our African-American art collection. We have one of the best contemporary and historical African-American art collections of any museum in the country. And we're actually moving those galleries closer to the center of the museum, right off of Rivera Court, where the Impressionists and Van Gogh paintings are. Before, they were kind of tucked away in the back of the museum, and visitors were always asking how to get there. So we're moving it closer to the heart of the museum, as well as we are reinterpreting the collection and really telling the story of African-American history, art history, and culture using the artwork in our collection. It's going to be incredible. However, most of our African-American artwork will be off view until October, mid-October, when those galleries are going to reopen. And along with that reopening, we're going to have an educator workshop that talks about the reinstallation. And we're also developing some really robust learning resources, classroom resources that teachers can use to help engage their students in that part of the collection.
We're currently with Jason Gillespie from the Detroit Institute of Arts talking about some of the exciting changes coming to the Institute. Jason, before we move on to another topic, I have a question. As a museum, do you have a way to know what is more popular than certain things in the museum based on foot traffic, or because once you're in the museum, you pretty much can go wherever you'd like, correct?
Correct, yes.
So do you, as a museum, track what is considered to be most popular? The reason I ask this is I had the opportunity to see the Mona Lisa last fall, and it was absolutely overwhelming with people. And there was really no rhyme or reason to how you could come up and see the Mona Lisa. And I think they're in the process of negotiating some movement of it or something to better navigate the flow of people. And I just wonder, at our institute, do you have a sense of what's more popular than others? And did that play a role in moving things around in the museum?
We do. We do have, actually, it was really quite something for me coming from K-12 into museum education. We have an entire department around research and evaluation. So there's a group of really talented people that we can go to and get information like that. Which I would have killed for in K-12 education. usually more though for our exhibitions, we'll actually have people counters that are put on the entrances and exits to the exhibition spaces that count people back and forth. We can do some stuff with cell phones and kind of geofencing and geolocating people within the space. But also for my program, it's like, what are teachers requesting? What types of field trips are they requesting? We track all of that. We know what our most popular tours are. And then it's just anecdotal evidence with our volunteers and the museum. You know, they get people asking them, hey, where can I find this? Where can I find that? And then they report that back to us. So, but we know that our African-American collection is so strong and so heavily visited by the community that we really want to make that a center point for our museum.
And just for our School Talks listeners, Mr. Gillespie here is a seasoned educator, having worked in education for many years before coming to the DIA. So you certainly are in the right position to navigate all of those issues.
Yeah.
So with the time we have remaining, I really want to talk for a minute about TIF Massey.
Okay.
And the 7 Mile and Livernois Project. Tell us a bit about that, because I understand that is coming down soon at some point.
Yeah, mid-May, I believe. Yeah, that has been an incredible exhibition. This is a local artist, as the name of the exhibition implies, 7 Mile in Livernois. TIF Massey was, I believe, the first African-American female artist to get an MFA in metal smithing from Cranbrook Art School. And she began her career making jewelry, but then transformed her jewelry into architectural scale. And her work really speaks about adornment and identity and aesthetics. How do we adorn our bodies? How do we adorn our buildings? How do we make our spaces more beautiful, more creative? And so we've actually commissioned her to do a bunch of pieces for this show that are in the exhibition. It will be up until mid-May. And Robert, there's going to be a huge party at when it closes. We've brought in a couple of DJs while her exhibition has been going on. One was three or four weeks ago. We had over 2,000 people in the building on a Friday night. And these were young people. These were black and brown people that we want in the museum, and new audiences. It was really great to see, to have the museum activated like that. And we're going to have one more in May, and everyone should go. It's going to be a huge party and a lot of fun.
And, you know, in my limited exposure to this project, one of the ways I would describe the work that she does is she takes something that might otherwise be jewelry,
right,
and she makes it life-size.
Yeah.
And it becomes a reflection of the culture and the identity of, in this case, the neighborhood where lots of that metalwork exists. And until you see it in person, it's really tough to wrap your arms around. So,
yeah.
Jason Gillespie, the Walters Family Director of Education from the Detroit Institute of Arts, I really appreciate you stopping by and updating us on all the good stuff happening there. And to all of our educators out there, don't hesitate to take advantage of this wonderful resource. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Robert.
When we come back, we'll chat with Mallory Applewhite from the American Heart Association. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernois.
Joining us now in the program is Vice President of Community Impact for the American Heart Association, Mallory Applewhite. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Mallory, we all know the importance of cardiac emergency response in really any sector of our society, but it seems ever so important in the school setting, given the number of children in one location and so on. And I understand in the mission of the American Heart Association, you've made a really concerted effort to develop these plans and make them available for schools. And could you share with us what are the key elements or the basic ideas behind a cardiac emergency response plan?
Cardiac emergency response plan essentially equips organizations and schools with the tools, resources, education, and protocol on how to act in case of a cardiac arrest.
And in that case, how is a cardiac plan different than any other emergency response plan? What are some of the differences?
Cardiac emergency response plan certainly focuses on cardiac arrests happening at sites or on locations. And really the difference is really what the purpose is of that plan. But essentially, a cardiac emergency response plan should be looked at as a fire drill or any other drills or plans within institutions that equipped that site with what to do in case of any emergency.
So in the scope of a plan, as you know, schools have lots of plans for crisis and fire drills and whatnot. And in the cardiac response plan, do people have certain roles that they serve in responding to someone in distress?
So within that cardiac response plan, there are individuals who are identified as leads, if you will, to really act in case of that emergency. So you have someone that is designated as your 911 dialer to get those EMS and first responders to the site of the incident. You also have folks who should be responsible for crowd control. We want to make sure that we have ample amount of space to ensure that the individual who's suffering a cardiac arrest is getting the care they need. Additionally, there should be someone designated to go retrieve the AED device, as well as begin CPR on that individual. So there are a number of roles that are a part of this plan.
And within that plan, you mentioned 911. Does the plan also have someone go outside to greet the ambulance?
Usually, the person who's on the phone with 911 should also be at the door to greet those first responders, to guide them to where the incident site is, to make sure they are there and ready to act.
And, you know, when you think about all the moving parts of a plan like this, it seems important to remember that people are under pressure. Obviously, right? This isn't a drill. And when they're under pressure, people tend to act sometimes differently. And many people don't really know how they would act in a situation like that. And to that end, can you explain the importance of collaboration among team members when it's not a drill?
We all know that practice makes perfect. And so when it comes to a plan, practicing your drill, practicing that actual protocol on what to do is imperative. And so part of the plan, it's a requirement that there is an annual drill, practice, and review for that plan to enhance, to make any changes and adjustments as organizations and even schools evolve.
And do you know, is a cardiac response plan required of schools?
Yes. In this next school year, the 25-26 school year, it will be a requirement for schools to have a cardiac emergency response plan in place, inclusive of an AED device, as well as CPR credentialed staff.
And I know in my experience, I would imagine most schools already have AED devices. One of the foremost challenges is to make sure that they are regularly inspected, much like a fire extinguisher or things like that. And they're in a good place to be ready. You know, given the requirement coming in the fall, what are some of the challenges you anticipate in implementing a successful response plan in any number of schools? And how are those expected challenges addressed in the training that you offer through the Heart Association?
You know, Robert, you asked a really great question. And to your point, those AED devices, they do need to be maintained as well as in locations that are accessible. So one of the biggest challenges that we encounter with any organization or entity is the placement of those devices. Are they accessible? Are they in a room locked away with a key that no one can get to? And so part of our role is to come into organizations, identify where these devices are currently located. Is there a need to move them? Or depending on the size of the establishment, is there a need for multiple devices? Because our goal is to make sure that that device is in within a 3-minute distance, if you will, from any site of an incident.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're currently with Vice President of Community Impact, for the American Heart Association, Mallory Applewhite, talking about the importance of cardiac emergency response plans in schools. You know, you mentioned proximity. In my experience, I think every school we have has one right outside the door of the gymnasium, just given the potential for athletics and whatnot. And in the spirit of that, as you sort of venture into next fall, well, how does the Heart Association plan to support the continuous improvement and use of these plans over time?
Part of the plan is required that organizations practice this drill protocol reviewing of their plan annually. And so we support organizations year over year to ensure that their plans are efficient, effective, and are certainly meeting the needs of the current state of their organization.
Yeah, and, you know, downstate here where it's heavily populated, I think a lot about rural settings where a hospital might be an hour or 2 hours away. And how does the Heart Association anticipate the distance that plays into a response and the eventual arrival of the medical, the ambulance and whatnot? And I'm just curious, are there any guidelines that are somewhat different for that rural setting?
The guidelines are not different. Cardiac emergency response plan includes 8 evidence-based practices and protocols that should be included in every plan. However, rural, to your point, is such a huge focus of ours because of that distance. And so our goal is to really work with any rural organization and even businesses to get those AED devices and CPR-educated individuals in the community, because we do know that the response time is a little longer.
Sure. And even with a automatic defibrillator, the need to have that response be as quick as possible is critical. One last thought. How is the Heart Association promoting this forthcoming requirement for schools? And what are some of the efforts you're doing to get the word out?
We have a great opportunity to connect with multiple schools throughout Michigan through several organizations, such as their Health Coordinators Association, if you will. And so having the opportunity to present the tools and resources that the American Heart Association has developed has been a great tool of ours.
Mm-hmm. Mallory Applewhite, the Vice President of Community Impact for the American Heart Association, appreciate your time today on the program, and most importantly, the great work you're doing with cardiac response plans. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
As we close out today's program, my conversation with our guest makes me appreciate just how many wonderful opportunities there are for students and families here in Metro Detroit. Many thanks to Amy Green from the Belle Isle Nature Center, Claire Lanoy Hall from the Detroit Zoo, and Jason Gillespie from the Detroit Institute of Arts. And rounding out the program, Mallory Applewhite from the American Heart Association. That's all the time we have for today. But remember, there are 2 ways to spell 1 and 3 ways to spell 2. Until next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.